It's 8 o'clock. I'm going to call the meeting to order. We have Peter Monca in person, and we have, I can see, Mike McClinsky, Richard Fast, Brian Wheeler, and Bill Trotshire on the phone definitely. And we think that Mike Dukanoy will be coming in or calling in. And it's at 8 a.m. that I called. Public comment on non-agenda items. And I'll wait a second because I know people need to mute their phones if they're calling, in. Or I think you can also text on this as well. Is there a chat feature?
There is. I just have it up there on the screen if somebody would like to type in the chat comment.
Okay, hearing no public comments, I'll go around and ask for any declaration of conflict of interest. Peter, first.
None.
Dick Fast, do you have any conflicts?
No, thank you.
Brian Wheeler, any conflicts?
I might just see the Sneakgrass Hills. How
about the Montana Club?
Montana Club. I might have a few. So I do have a few potential conflicts of interest, and I will disclose those as they surface.
Perfect. Mike McClinsky.
No conflicts.
Bill Schrockfryer.
No conflicts.
And I have a conflict.
Owner, can you hear me?
So with that, I'll move on to the consent agenda. Does anybody from the board have any comments or questions about the consent agenda?
Why don't you stick around one?
Hi, this is Dick. Just curious how we're standing on the ponds. Are they looking about average, or are we above or below?
Grant's not in the room. I'll get an update on that after our meeting. We're not in the worst position we've ever been. We're not in the best. Our irrigation number has been very strong for the last couple of weeks, and Spanish Peaks is putting up some pretty big numbers as well. So from an irrigation standpoint,
we think with the dry weather, we ought to be able to really pump some water on the horses and on the pastures. Any other comments, questions? With that, I would entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Make a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Then Bill Schrockfryer? We need a second first.
I second.
Mike McClinsky second. Peter Monca made the motion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Unanimously. With that, I'll turn it over to Ryan. I see there is no business action items. So.
Correct. So we've got some old business that we'll cover. I did want to take a minute just to talk about the minutes. This is a significant deviation from what we've typically done or historically done. So as you know, we're recording these meetings and putting them on our website. Link at the top here, and then listing who's in attendance for the meeting. This list here comes from the login file that's created by GoToMeeting. It's who's on the call, and some of the calls are just a straight call and phone number, so I put those in. And then it's just timestamps as we go through the agenda, so you all just approved it, so I assume it's okay, but if that's satisfactory to everybody, that would be my intent going forward.
One modification is, can you note any votes we take on business actions?
Yes, and then, I do actually have that, and it was off to the right, so I'll fix it so it prints.
Yeah, because I would like to see if we vote on something, what the vote was, and, you know, whether it was unanimous or not.
Yeah,
so.
And that's a good point, and I will correct that. And you did do, I think it was 3 votes at the last meeting, so. This is kind of modeled after what Gallatin County does with their reporting. So. All right. Now we got Scott Buechers on the call. You want to unmute yourself, Scott?
On my Twitter, first of all, I apologize that the I sent it from the road and it had some rough notes in the beginning of it that should have been erased. The rest of it's complete and what I wanted to express, so I'm just going to run through it real quick. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. We're about sitting at about 85% complete overall. We're going to cut a 90 for meter review, and I'd like to have a workshop with Grant and Ron at minimum. And we can invite, you know, any of the board members that want to attend remotely to that, I think in the first week of August. Once we have that 90 review and all our internal comments up to date, we'll send that to DEQ for their review prior to bid.
Scott, will you make sure the board is divided?
Yes.
Thank you.
Sure thing. We have been continuing our just weekly design check-in meetings with Ron and Grant, going over mixer selection, blower selection, site civil, mechanical HVAC choices, and we touch on architectural in those meetings. I believe Tanner was going to be present today and present the latest rendering of the facility and walk you through that. Cost estimates, I do want to update you on, we did bid Belgrade last week. Our engineer's estimate was $30 million. The lowest bid came in at $33 million. And the second bidder, we only received 2 bids, was $41 million. That was Dick Anderson Construction. The winning bidder was Strategic Construction Solutions out of Arizona, there, who's building Four Corners plant right now. That looks like, last I heard, that was a good bid. So that's who they're going to move forward with. But just again, that's significantly higher than our estimates, and it does appear to be about concrete, primarily labor, and equipment prices. I'd like to get more info from that contractor once we're a little further along as to what is leading to the inflation the most, but just want to give you a heads up that it's not any friendlier of a bidding environment than it was a year ago.
Do we have need to say, for instance, concrete and say, this is what your bid included for price, and then if the price deviates that negative, you know, gets better, that we would share in that price?
I'm not sure I understand exactly your question, Tom, but I'd be happy to talk.
Can we get a, if prices go down on concrete, can we have it go down? Or fine?
We faded out there. So essentially a cost share between the owner and the contractor if concrete prices drop after bidding?
Yes.
I've used that method before in Design Assist or progressive design bid or design build. I'm not sure that we'd be allowed to use it in design bid build, but it's a good question. I could at least talk to SRF and Terry Campbell about it and see if it's possible. Okay. Schedule's in good shape. Budget's in good shape overall. Nexus's impact fee, we're just thinking, is going to wait until we have bid prices at this point. We're close enough to this fall's bidding date that we might as well wait and have that number correct in their math. Other studies.
Shower,
indirect potable reuse. Mark Kinney, I believe, is on the call and will give us an update on his aquifer model that will, I think, deserves a good 15 to 30 minutes regarding what he's finding and what it means for both Firelight Meadows potential annexation, but also the indirect potable reuse study in general. The biggest issue on the Firelight Meadows side is not much data, and the data we do have is confusing. Looks like what Firelight Meadows has been putting into the ground has been going through some potential subsurface treatment before it gets to the monitoring wells, and the concentrations, particularly of nitrogen at the monitoring wells, are quite low compared to what they're putting in. So while that all sounds like a good thing, we just need to be clear on what it means if the district were to take over those disposal, those rapid infiltration basins in terms of the TMDL that we have on those beds. So we'll get into that a bit more. I won't dive into it right now. District Engineering Services, we had a couple of conversations with Terry Campbell last week. It came to Ron and my attention that DEQ had some confusion as to how many SFEs the district has left to award on the wastewater side. And we're not sure where that came from or how they got that notion. But we met with Terry. Ron walked him through, excuse me. Ron walked him through how uniquely the district deals with SFEs on a square footage basis, and that based on that, you know, some residences actually have more than one SFE, and so that seemed to appease Terry. We also gave him Ray Armstrong's past capacity letters, so we think we're over that road bump, and Terry's now back where he understands that there are enough. At least based on past development rates, there's enough SFEs in the bank to get us through to construction and startup of the new plant. Other than that, we're working on phosphorus and fog ordinances and guidance for the district on inspections. And that's about it. So I'll be in touch in regards to a 90% design workshop. We'll work on a DEQ submittal and still bidding this fall.
That's me.
Any questions or anything anybody wants to dig into deeper now?
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
I see we've got, I assume 45 Architecture is Tanner on the call. I'm going to jump down. We actually have the latest plant rendering hanging up behind me here. And it's also in my report. But you got, I think, a better version than that. I scanned the one you left in the office here, Tanner. Put it in my report. Do you want to share your screen or just speak without presenting anything.
I like the big horn sheep. Did they come with the instructions in?
And it's not like he, I don't know, didn't we kind of go over this last meeting?
What's that?
Our approval of one of the designs and...
Yeah, this is a takeoff from,
okay.
Hey.
Banner, are you able to unmute yourself?
They're unmuted on my screen, Ron, but I'm not hearing anything.
Council suggested we come back to that. If you can, there's also a phone number, Tanner, you can call into our conference phone, 995-2661, if you want to try that. So I'm going to move down to, the firelight work, and Mark Kinane is on the call. Got a PowerPoint from Mark that I'll pull up.
And just for clarification, his presentation today is what is the difference between that and the last one?
Correct.
I don't know what the difference is.
And Mark, if you want to take over.
So, Ron,
are you able to hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, you can hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so the information I presented at the meeting last month was all derived out of the groundwater flow model. And so I got as far as the path lines, which are basically showing you the directions of groundwater flow and the travel time. And what I have now is I've completed the transport modeling, which is where I'm using a computer code that I actually input mass loadings of constituents, in this case total nitrogen, and that model uses the flow model also, but it simulates the movement of the constituents in groundwater. So it adds dispersion, it can add reaction processes that are not present in the flow model. So we can go to the next slide, Ron, please. So this slide is just kind of there'll be a cost-benefit analysis for discharging at Firelight Meadows, and this is just some information about the benefit of the discharge during the winter when otherwise the district would be storing treated effluent. If it is to work out that the Firelight Meadows system can be used, there'd be a net of about 1,172 SFE acquired that otherwise would have to have been stored in the winter. So that's the overall benefit of this system. And just kind of an informational slide. It doesn't really have to do with the modeling. The rate that's based on is the 208,000 gallons per day. That is used in the model. And I guess all I'll mention here also is, well, no, I'll hold on to that. Has to do with the loading, but, anyway, that's the net benefit. Firelight is 146 SFE. You deduct that from the total, that gives you the net SFE. You can go to the next one, Ron.
Just to put that in perspective, that's maybe 15% more than what Armstrong's most recent letters have said you have in terms of capacity for discharge. So not insignificant.
So this slide's just a refresher of what the model is and where it is. So it extends through the entire Meadow Village area to the south of Firelight Meadows, where the alluvium disappears and bedrock is mapped at the surface. The Middle Fork, West Fork channels represented in the model, Trail Creeks represented in the model. There's some groundwater inflow, that's that blue line on the west, northwest part of the model, that's groundwater inflow. And then the yellow cells all along the southeast edge are where the alluvium daylights above the South Fork channel. So the alluvium doesn't actually ever contact the South Fork channel. There's bedrock in the terrace scarp. All along, it's mapped that way by the USGS, and I went out and visited several sites along that terrace scarp to verify that, and that is the case I found. So that's how the model is. There's an evapotranspiration area along the Middle Fork, West Fork channels that's kind of outlined in just that yellow line that's adjacent to the channel. And those are, riparian areas where we have very shallow groundwater and wetland plants. So you're actually evapotranspiring groundwater directly in those areas. Then Firelight Meadows, we've got the three outfalls. Now, in the flow model, I just represented them as wells. In the transport model, they're represented differently so that it's an aerial distribution of the discharge. And then the district's pumping wells north, on the north side of the golf course, those are also included. So we can go to the next slide, please. So this slide, that white beige area is the extent of the discharge plume from the existing Firelight Meadows. So that's the 23,000 gallons per day. And what I've done with the model here is I've used some reactions that decay nitrogen so that I basically exactly match the median concentration at the two Firelight Meadows mixing zone monitoring wells. So those are MW2, they're labeled, and MW1. So MW2 is down gradient from outfalls 001 and 002. MW1 is down from outfall 003, and so this is what gives us the map. And what Scott mentioned earlier was that in order to match that, I'm basically removing about 90% of the nitrogen that enters, that leaves the drain field and goes into the subsurface. And that's a bit of a conundrum. There is kind of a theoretical basis you could do that. Most of the nitrogen is ammonia, 80%+ of it. And when you, if you have a lot of carbon in your soil, you can absorb that ammonia onto the soils. But it should come through. It should break through all. And so the Firelight Meadows data consisted of only nitrogen data. We would have liked to have had chloride as well, because that gives us another calibration parameter. And if you, we had eight values for the last 2 years of quarterly data, and seven of those all hovered around a concentration of 2 milligrams per liter as nitrogen at the monitoring wells. Okay. The last sample shot up to 18.5 at one of the wells and about 6 at the other. And the recent, the most recent data, which they just collected for quarter two, was a little lower, but it was still higher than the initial 7 values. And so that ends up being a significant issue for what this project goal is, because one of the criteria that we're keeping the discharge quantity on is that the mass loading of the nitrogen will be no greater than the existing mass loading from the Firelight Meadows district. And it'll actually, in practice, it would actually be lower than that mass loading, because we're basing the mass loading on the maximum nitrogen that would be produced from the new plant. So in practice, the nitrogen will be maybe up to that maximum at some times a year, but below it at other times a year. So overall, the district's takeover of FMS, if this goes forward, would result in a lower mass loading. And that's favorable for the TMDL, total maximum daily load, limits on the surface waters in the area. And so as long as you're falling below their load, you're achieving what is hoped to achieve in the total maximum daily load framework, which is a lowering of that parameter, the load of that parameter. So when we have this case of needing to remove a large percentage of the nitrogen to match the existing well monitoring well data, we're essentially reducing the effective load of the Firelight Meadows facility, and therefore the actual discharge that the district could realize. So it ends up being a fairly major issue. And so one of the recommendation that's come out of this work, and I'll go over that, is that we need to collect more data on the groundwater, and some on the treated effluent. And we need to collect that at a higher frequency and nail down what's going on out there in terms of the actual loading of the nitrogen to groundwater. So this next slide will provide a little more background for what I just said. If you can go to that, please, Ron. So here is the simulation of Firelight Meadows where I am not trying to match the monitoring wells. And with the loading that occurs there, we end up with concentrations at the monitoring wells of 20 to 30 milligrams per liter nitrogen. And, you know, we extend out into, you know, fairly high numbers quite a ways to the northeast in the plume. And so that is you know, there is some nitrogen that does not show up in the groundwater, but this is at the full load. So there's quite a contrast between what we're seeing in the existing data and what we would expect when we model, you know, to model that treated effluent district.
Mark?
Yes?
Is there a possibility that there's some discrete, you know, plume or channel of nitrogen transfer that we're missing or monitoring. That's what's throwing this model off.
Well, of course, that's, we can't see that down under there, so that's unknown, but we don't see indications of that generally in the geology, although we don't have many data points on that either. You know, and one of the recommendation includes putting in up to 4 new monitoring wells, which would give us more data. Generally, you don't see people, you know, driller logs that are describing, you know, alluvium sands and gravels. You know, you can have channeling in that, but at this point, you know, we don't know of that.
So the assumption is that the alluvium is fairly consistent in nature and we should be seeing an even spread that nitrogen level.
That's what I would expect, what I know from looking at the situation. You know, one of the things about the alluvial aquifer dislocation is that it's not developed. And the reason for that is because when you drill through it, you generally don't produce much water out of it because there's a very thin saturated thickness. And so, you know, in that way, we don't have a way to characterize the degree of heterogeneity or homogeneity, you know, because we're not able to look at, it's good there is not many wells in it, by the way, but if any, you know, we're not able to see, oh, this well here could pump 60 gallons a minute airlift and this one was 5. You know, we don't have that kind of data for this aquifer in this area. And, you know, part of the, we will collect some hydraulic data and gradation analysis and so on out of these monitoring wells if that recommendation is implemented. But right now, we just don't have a lot of different data points in that alluvial aquifer.
Got it. Okay, thanks.
We can go to the next one, Ron. So here's the nitrogen discharge plume when the for the scenario where the district is operating at 208,000 gallons per day and a maximum of 5 milligrams per liter as nitrogen. And so what you see here is the extent of the plume is larger than the existing discharge, which is quite, you know, one-fifth less than one-tenth the flow, but the concentrations hover about through the center of the plume between 2 and 3 milligrams nitrogen per liter. There is generally the discharge locations are the same. The one thing we don't know, or we don't expect happens in the actual system is that there's much, if any, discharge along the South Fork channel. There's no evidence of any springs in that area that I've seen. You know, you could crawl along that bank and look at every inch of it. It certainly, you know, there's no areas that are identified on the USGS topo as a spring along that discharge. And the increase in discharge here is, you know, you're at 144 gallons per minute under this scenario versus 16 gallons per minute for the Firelight Meadow subdivision. And considering the extent of the alluvial material that exists, those are still quite low flows in both cases. So not expecting there's much, if any, discharge to the South Fork. And if there were, you would be taking away that discharge from the Middle Fork, right? So you're not just, you know, you can't just add the load to the South Fork without decreasing the load to the Middle Fork. So overall, you know, total maximum daily load out in the West Fork is unchanged through the, you know, this scenario here. And if we look at the next slide.
Mark, you might just clarify that that's assuming 5 milligrams per liter in the effluent.
Right. Let's go back to that last slide, Ron. Sorry. The only, I thought I put in the slide I ran at 50% low, but I did not. But basic, and that's in our report. But at the 50% low, there's just not much difference in terms of the extent of the plume and the concentrations in the plume. They're slightly lower, and then the extent slightly smaller. And you know that's how that turns out. So now we can go to the next.
The 50% is assuming 104,000 gallons a day instead of 208. Is that what you mean by 50% load?
Yeah, you'd be 104, exactly. Okay. So, yeah.
And with no degradation or treatment.
Right. So the outcome of this work, from what I've seen, is we need to establish that load out of the existing FMS facility. And so step one is install up to 4 monitoring wells. There'd be 1 up gradient well and 3 down gradient wells, basically located in proximity to the drain field areas. Okay. And in those boreholes, we get samples for analysis of gradations, cation exchange capacity, soil carbon. We do slug tests, which is an easy way to get some hydraulic data on the aquifer. And then the water quality data would be twice a month, biweekly, for 1 year. You know, we can, of course, review that, but that's a solid program. And we have the district personnel collect the samples, except for the first round. And the monitoring wells would all get equipped with pumps. So it would be a matter of driving up to the well, with a generator, portable generator in the pickup, and running the well to waste to properly purge it, and then collecting the sample through a filter. They're not filtering any of their samples now, and you know, standard practice, it would be a 0.45 micron filter. So that would be included. And then you do the nutrients, major ions, total organic carbon, dissolved organic carbon, pH, conductivity. And then those data would be evaluated, and we could update the transport model and the report. And I do think also recommending that the report, as it sits now, it would be useful to send that to DEQ, get their feedback on the approach, which they can review right away, or start to review right away.
Hey, Mark, per Peter Manka's question, the existing monitoring wells, the way I understood your report or discussions with you, they're not ideal from a monitoring well perspective, and we're not sure that they're being operated ideally during a sampling event. Is that all correct?
Yeah. The MW2 is actually an irrigation well. So that's got, there's apparently some good water there for them to use that well for irrigation. And it's got a larger pump in it than you would certainly sample with. And so right now, for example, that well's running, quite a bit more than it would be in the winter. And that may have an effect on the sampling. And then the MW1 location is just being baled. So there, you know, there's quite a difference in the amount of purging going on at that location when they collect the sample. But the plan is to include those wells, not disregard them. They would be included. We would certainly look at that irrigation well, MW2, and maybe consider dropping it if it was seemed like we weren't getting good, you know, consistent data from it. Hey, Mark, we go to the next slide. Yes?
So would there be some advantage in incorporating some private wells into the monitoring network? Those would be primarily the southwest of Ouzel Falls Drive. Basically, every lot on there has a individual well. I'd say there's probably 8 or 10 lots over there. Something like that.
Yeah, we've got that to sample those just once. And my thought on that was if we see, you know, because they're completed down in the bedrock.
Right.
And there is a possibility for connection, you know, along those well casings. And so my thought is we'll identify up to about 5 wells is what I identified. And we'll contact those landowners, and if we can get permission to sample those, we go ahead and do one round there. And depending on what we find, we may want to do more sampling from them, but that's the way I left it now is with one round of samples. And that's, you know, we're certainly not finalized on that plan, but that's as far as I thought about it at this time.
So in that location, what's the depth of the alluvium approximately?
Right at Firelight Meadows, the alluvium thickness from land surface down to the top of bedrock can be about 60 feet.
60 feet. And most of those wells are completed, what, 150, 200 feet?
Yeah, or more. I mean, there's certainly some, I believe, that are over 300. I'd have to look back at it, but yeah, they're completed at quite a bit more greater depth.
Gotcha. So we wouldn't anticipate necessarily any direct connection unless they're running down the casing or somehow else channeling. What about on the kind of northeast margin of the, with the plume there, there's some private wells there that may be in alluvium. Isn't there that one? There's that, there's those productive wells on the northeast side. They're at the base of the hill along Spruce Drive that goes out there.
Oh, yeah, there are a few wells in there.
There's an artesian.
Right. Patty drilled that years ago.
That's in the bedrock.
Leaves.
None of those are probably into alluvium.
Don't think so.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I'm not sure exactly where you were trying to describe here, but I did not find any wells in proximity to Firelight Meadows that were completed up in the alluvium.
Okay.
In Utah. Maybe
like directly north of Monitoring Well 2, somewhere in that region. And there are some new wells that are going in to the east of Monitoring Well 2. There's some development going on there. But I don't know where those wells are drilled into either, so. Maybe worth looking at a couple of those new wells in case anybody did end up in the alluvium there. Just a opportunity to piggyback and maybe get a little more data that a little less cost.
Yeah, we can certainly look into that. So moving on then to the budget item. One of the considerations here was, I thought that this data should be collected and owned by the district. And so, just thinking about this project and moving forward, I think it's important that the district collect and have a high quality data set on this part of the analysis, since it ultimately determines the load. So the monitoring wells, here's the itemization for everything for the budget estimate. You can read that. I won't go through it, but the monitoring wells, that's the contractor up the top. That includes the well drilled approximately 60 feet and equipped with a pumping system. The water quality sampling, the lab, that's the full year for all that analysis. I got it quoted out of, what's now Pace Analytical out of Sheridan, Wyoming. They used to be Intermountain Lab. I've worked with them for years, and that includes a freight charge to get that down there. And that's about it. Yeah, that's about it. So, that's the certainly feasible. The district wants to move ahead with this, and we can get permission from Firelight Meadows. It's certainly feasible to get the monitoring wells installed this year and get started on the program.
Mark, this is Scott. Is that $49,500 of lab costs? Is that a year program?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's $160 a sample, and I put in $60 for express freight, and that includes 3 samples of treated effluent and 6 samples out of monitoring wells. So if you take the 4 new ones plus the existing 2, so we're looking at 9 samples per event. Twice a month.
Okay. So 24 times 9 total samples. 26.
It's every 2 weeks. Yeah. 26.
For a suite of, the whole suite of basically priority pollutants.
I have a general question, that goes beyond, the work that Mark has done, but are we at a stage now that it looks promising enough that we need to do some more work, but we don't even have any kind of memorandum of understanding or anything with Firelight that we can come to an agreement if this does make sense to proceed on this? So we could spend another $133,000, and then if we said from our standpoint it was a go, if we couldn't reach a reasonable agreement with this money would be spent without any reward. So should our next step be trying to come up with some kind of agreement that if it does, the science does, then we should move forward on this, that we know what it's going to mean for both Firelight, for West Fork Utilities, and for Water and Sewer District?
I'll take the first cut, Mark, and then you come in and sweep up. But Tom, we're still in your, what I would call your due diligence phase. So what Mark has realized is that Firelight Meadows is discharging a relatively low amount of higher strength stuff into their beds. And for whatever reason, they're appear to be getting removal, or the plume just isn't hitting the monitoring wells, or whatever. So you've got low concentrations of total nitrogen at their monitoring wells historically. And that's the goalpost you're going to be scored against by DEQ for how much you get to discharge. So it's not really very good news. It's not good news for you that concentrations at the monitoring wells is so low. That said, there is a spike this spring in that monitoring. So maybe we're just seeing the system now getting overwhelmed, and the loading at those monitoring wells would be higher. Therefore, you get more capacity, you get more discharge, and it could be good for you. But more work has to be done to make sure that we understand what's happening out there and you understand what you're taking on before, I think the negotiation begins. There's also quite a bit of infrastructure required to annex Firelight Meadows on just, for example, on the wastewater collection side, just to get their waste into your system for you to treat it, for you to return it, you know, pressure reducing vaults and pipeline and, we have a rough idea of how much that costs, but a lot of that depends on whether or not you can reuse those beds or if you want to build new ones. So I think you're still a little early in terms of that. I mean, if you want an MOU that says, you know, both parties are working on this with the idea that if it is mutually beneficial, they would proceed. You'd see something like that, but I'm not sure how much teeth that would have anyway.
Well, I'm just concerned about if we did all this science, which is what we need to do, and then the HOA realizes that they're going to have connection fees that they say they're not interested for whatever reason. Then we spent all this money and there's nothing good that comes out of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, we would need to give them.
It is a good point because it's a big effort to try to look at hooking up Firelight Meadows. And if this was a new development, we'd look at the SFEs with each condo unit. I think there's 220 condo units and the square footages. So there's an SFE component, and then they'd be paying the fees that are associated with that, which adds up to a lot of money. And so we have not gone through that exercise to figure out what that regular connection fee would look like. We could start working on that and try to get something in front of the owners association there. We also need to get permission to do all this work, and I assume that would involve some sort of agreement with Firelight Meadows for access to the scope, which I think Mark has laid out pretty well. But we've got a ways to go. Matt Huggins is on the meeting here. I was going to unmute Matt to see if he had any comment on this.
I'm just trying to figure out which is the cart and which is the horse. I don't know which is which.
Well, we have been verbally green-lighted to do whatever work we need to do, but we do need something in paper before, obviously, before monitoring wells would be installed.
And so I'm wondering if it's both, or if it's Westport Utilities, who owns the ground, would be the prime on some sort of agreement. Matt, do you have any comment on any of this?
So Tanner's been emailing me, Ron, on the side that he's unmuted on his end, but can't get any.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can hear
you. Okay, yeah, I called in on the conference line. Hey, Ron, I emailed you the rendering. I don't know if you want to pull it up on your end or allow me to share my screen, whichever you prefer.
Let me see if I can find it while we're wrapping this discussion up. Let me see if I can.
So
I just pointed that out because Matt, I don't know if Matt's having the same problem, but.
Well, it looks like he's muted though.
He's unmuted.
Okay.
Matt, you're unmuted there.
Matt, can you hear us?
Well, maybe he'll jump on here, but just to flesh out what Tom and Ron are saying is the district could certainly come up with the cost for the, you know, the per SFE cost. Mark Kunane and Mark Peterson and I can come up with, I think, a bracket of costs for the infrastructure. I'm not going to put a hard number on it because there's, you know, still unknowns in regards to what we do with the beds that are there versus building new ones. You know, obviously there's construction uncertainty, things like that, but I could put a bracket on those costs and then, you know, we could have sort of a mock-up of scenarios for the annexation negotiation that potentially could be put in front of Firelight and HLH to say, you know, talk amongst yourselves and tell us if this is still something that's feasible or not. Because if it's not, we don't want to keep spending all this money on the investigative front.
Scott, do you guys have any kind of map of where the additional proposed wells would be? Just a rough idea to describe them.
Mark, did you put those in your report yet?
Sorry, I couldn't hear that. Could you say that again?
Peter's asking if you have proposed locations for those four new monitoring wells.
No. No. One would certainly be in the southwest corner there, along Oosel Falls, and then the other three would be, two would be around the outfalls one and two, and one would be down at outfall three.
I would like to ask a question here. If the advantage to us is additional disposition capacity during the winter months, you know, how critical does the acquisition of the capacity at Firelight Meadows make us when we are up and running, let's say 5-10 years from now? But to me, that's, I think there's quite a risk in doing this with Firelight Meadows, but I don't want to close my mind to it. If in fact we really do need this disposition capacity, assuming that we're operating full bore 4, 5, 10 years out from it, and I think that if it is theoretical. If it is something that we're going to need in order to deal with all of the additional capacity that we're going to be taking on, I think we ought to just go ahead and spend the money and see where we are.
Let me take a run at that, Bill.
The other thing we have, too, is the potential of groundwater disposal down in the canyon. Mark, are we going to be doing work down there on the same kind of work down there?
Most likely, yes. We don't have any contract with Mark to do anything in the canyon per se. Scott, I don't know if you had Mark doing any work down there as part of the Gallon River Task Force contract.
But I guess the question is, what we need groundwater disposal sites.
Yep. So let's take it one at a time. I do want to talk about other options, including the canyon and snowmaking. But first, for Shropshire's question, I'm looking at Ray's last capacity letter, and he's saying that we have about 7,088 SFEs for treatment based on treatment capacity. So we're going to remove that roadblock with this treatment plant upgrade and expansion. But immediately after that, right now at least, we have a storage capacity bottleneck at 7,284 SFEs. So right after we start up that plant, we're going to have another roadblock, 200 SFEs in front of us, unless we get that additional 15.7 million gallons of YC storage completed. If that was completed, he's putting those SFEs at closer to 8,000. This, Mark has put the value of the SFEs for disposal at FMS, or Firelight, of 1,172 additional SFEs. So that would take us from that, let's just say that that storage, at, let's set aside the storage at YC. We got 7,284 SFEs based on storage capacity. We're going to add 1,172 because we don't need storage for this Firelight Meadows disposal. That would take you to about 8,400 or so, rough back of the envelope. The cost could be anywhere from, I think, 2 to 3 million infrastructure, and that includes collection side and getting the reuse water to these beds.
15% of substantial tidings.
Yeah, I think I'm hearing Peter correctly, but that's right. I think about it, about 15% additional SFEs of capacity for $2 to $3 million if it all flushes out okay. And
is there some advantage in having these monitoring wells long term? Established with a, if we don't go through with the Firelight project, we've got some monitoring wells there. If we do end up with some nitrogen loading in the South Fork, these are potentially data points and future access points for data to be gathered on that situation.
I would let Mark Kinane take that one.
Okay. Sorry about that. Could you repeat that, please?
Yeah, would establishing the additional monitoring wells potentially be beneficial down the road? Let's say even if we didn't follow through with the Firelight study, but if we ended up with some type of nitrogen loading in the South Fork or to investigate other situations that could potentially face us in the future.
Well, I think they're very specialized to this application. Without knowing what would come in the future, it would be hard to say. But unknown, I guess, would be best answer to that, Peter.
Okay.
So I think just take that 15% additional capacity at $2 to $3 million if it all works out in terms of this data collection versus what may or may not happen down in the canyon. I know Mace with WGM had given the task force a proposal for similar type work at some locations down in the canyon. I'm not sure where that is. And then I think, we also want to keep grinding away at snowmaking. Similar type capital costs, depending on DEQ, potentially with Class A-1 effluent, we would be done as long as the resort and Spanish Peaks would be willing to take the lead on it. And when I say done, I mean in terms of water quality.
You can?
Yeah. Hey, Mike, I don't know if you can hear us, but do we have any updates on your guys' progress or applications for snowmaking?
And the pot.
It's like we're having technical difficulties, maybe.
Mike's one of the calls. He's one of these callers. What? Mike, can you hear us?
He can hear you. He just can't. You can't hear him. He texted me. Just a heads up. A couple times I've tried to speak and it says host is muting me. I don't know if that's intentional or not.
We hear you now.
Just want to make sure. Didn't know if it was you, Ron.
Tanner, did you were not able to verbalize when you were using GoToMeeting audio or computer audio, but when you called in you're able to obviously be heard.
Yeah, that's what happened with me. I just ended up calling in.
Can't believe it's that easy to mute you, Brian.
It isn't, Dick. I thought it was maybe Ron getting even, but that's okay.
Well, now that we've got you, Brian, do you have any comments on things that we discovered earlier?
I got everything, and I just am happy to be able to talk now.
Well, I don't know. To me, it seems like we ought to at least get in front of the HOA and we're going to wire lines and understand where, you know, their thoughts are, because they're going to have to pay connection fees, right? I mean, legally.
What was our kind of last jumping off point with them was basically,
I don't think we had much with them. Not officially, anyway.
There were conversations with the Westport Utilities.
Yes.
Correct. That pragmatically this could work. Financial impact, or the practicality of the HOA doing this.
Well, we did get a chat from Carla, who's on the meeting. I just pulled it up there. She's the board member for Firelight Meadows. You can read it there.
And we did have a meeting with them, and you know, they were very interested. It's not just the SFEs, it's all the infrastructure, and going to be a negotiation, and so I think what you all are asking for is reasonable, which is put some brackets on it and get it in front of them and make sure they still are nodding heads that they want to participate, and maybe they can do some cost sharing of all this exploratory work.
Do we want a subcommittee maybe and meet with Matt and Carla and discuss where we're at before we jump into this?
We could, does it, should it be just staff? I mean,
sure.
What would the board need to
audit them? So we just got a report back.
But I think they need some, scale of what the costs are. I think legally, we don't have a right to give, discounts on connection fees, do we?
You can negotiate. You have, that's a legal question, but if you're getting some benefit from disposal, that benefits more than just what you're taking on, I would think that would be something you could negotiate.
Generating some value for the ratepayer.
I understand. I don't know what the law says.
Yeah, whatever we would do would have to be compliant with the law. You do have the ability to enter into contracts. services. I've always felt that if Firelight's taken on, it should be an annexation type of approach. And reason for that is we've still got a lot of our bond debt on the tax roll that would then be spread in on top of the recent Firelight House. So it essentially build our tax base if we annex that. And I think if they're getting service, they should be part of that bear group that's benefiting from having this treatment plant. So have them paying tax for that makes some sense.
I'm just concerned that there is going to be some bill to them for joining the district, and I would just want them to understand what those parameters were before we get too far along on this and then say, well, yeah, we're not really interested at that price.
It's a fair comment.
We've kind of been at that point for a while, I think.
But I think now's the time to, and maybe we take a dual track, but that we just need to figure out where their mindset is.
Mark, what's your timing on installing new wells? What would the timeline be?
Well, this year, I haven't talked to any drillers. You know, step one would be we'd have to, we don't have to, we're under the limit for public bidding, so we could put together a spec and send out and get quotes from probably the same folks we had on the existing Mount Test Wells project. And, it just depends on how that turns out, but I don't have a timeline for them right now. But it's a short amount of work. Should be able to build two of these in a day. So I don't expect us to not be able to do it this year.
I mean, could we start on some of the
no data gathering this year, just completion of the wells? Is that what I understood?
Repeat that, Peter. I didn't catch it all.
So the goal would be to complete the wells this year and maybe begin data gathering like in the fall, late fall?
That would be what we'd hope to do. I mean, once the wells are in, you can start the program.
Right.
Well, so, we could, if we got West Fork Utilities to say, okay, I'm drilling the wells, we could spend $15,000 or $16,000 now, and then to move forward, we could start some kind of discussion with the HOA and get their at least tacit approval that they still
want to
go forward on this without spending the rest of the
cost. Yes.
Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, only half of our, ration of 13,000 class is...
Or is the contractor 38?
Yeah, 50 yeah. would be to complete the wells.
53. So, I mean, should we not go all in on this right now and wait to hear back on a potential discussions with the HOA? Because I think Matt Huggins can make a decision, but you've got, 150 residents there that may say, who knows how they'll vote.
Could just get in the queue for getting these wells drilled.
Right. If
discussions don't go as hoped in the next month, plug before drilling a bunch of wells.
So Carla just chatted that their next HOA meeting is August 11th. I think we should probably try to
either
attend that either virtually or however they're setting that up. We have done one or two of those before, but we've got a lot of new information, obviously, so I think that makes sense to try to get there.
So can we just put this on hold and take it out at the next meeting, which is, the 20th or something like that in August?
be fine with me. And then if there are a couple board members who want to attend that, I'm sure you're welcome to hear that. Sounds like there's some interest in that as well.
Yeah, is my voice able to be, this is Carla. Am I being heard or not?
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay. So I've been kind of chatting some of the messages here. You know, I mean, I can't speak on behalf of everybody with 100% authority right now, but we have, as a board, been discussing this for many, many board meetings, many months, maybe kind of going on over a year. The need to be pursuing being annexed in everything, as all decisions, is definitely money dependent. And we do have 216 units. And so, we do have some procedures in which our ownership vote would have to, be involved for us to spend funds. But, generically, I would say, yes, we are interested.
Okay. If we own some kind of proposal as to what we think it would be, right? And we can also bond this out. Good point. Yeah,
Let's just, if we pull back for a second, the $133,335 that Mark has here is really driven towards understanding what's happening with their existing disposal. And so that's really crucial, you know, regardless. If we don't show that, there's a problem there at the loading on the loading side. This is somewhat dead in the water. So I guess what I'm saying is that money seems to be needed regardless. Go do that to just check the box of there's potential here or there's not potential here before you spend the additional, let's say it's $2.5 million for all the infrastructure and the SFE negotiation. And maybe the SFEs is not a negotiation. That's just, it is what it is, but there's some negotiation over infrastructure, but that's bigger money. But even though it's bigger money, it's still pretty reasonable based on what you all have to spend to acquire more SFEs, whether it be on treatment, disposal, or storage moving forward. And like I said, you know, you're going to get this plant. If everything goes well, started up in sometime summer of 2022, and it's going to take the handcuffs off on treatment, but there's going to be another roadblock right down the road on storage.
Well, could we at least bid out the wells in the next month and then, you know, get that far, and then it sounds like we can then talk to the HOA, because I hear you. You do need to do this work to approve or disprove it, but the other side of it too is there could be a no out of the HOA if their participation in the costs is untenable for them. So
how about Mark moving forward with you know, getting the drillers involved, getting in the queue?
Yes.
With a breakpoint decision that they basically come back to us before the actual drilling happens. And then we synthesize the information we have and make the judgment that way.
I'm good with that. If that can be done and it makes sense. How about, what do you think, Ron?
No, I think that's fine.
Mark, does that sound workable from your side?
Thank you.
Mark, how does this effort play into the Mountain Village project, which we'll talk about in a minute here, as far as your workload?
Well, it's separate. If we wanted to use the same driller, I don't know if we could write a change order to do that. I think we're just be taking away time from the Mount Test well. So I think that, you know, the, the, the better case would be to just get quotes from other drillers and see how that turns out and what their timing is like. And, you know, if there's something, if there's a firm that's more available, price wise, I expect they'll all be fairly similar. Wait and see, I guess, but, these are not high cost, projects to build. So, if we had the same driller, it would push the Mount Test wells back a little. Otherwise, you know, it's like I said, it should be, a couple days of work, a week of work, is what it ends up being.
I'm not sure I want to push back our water search either, so.
No, I don't. They're already going to run late, Bridger Drilling. Mark will speak to that in a minute, get through it on the agenda. But before we do any of this, I'd want to get some sort of written agreement put together that would give us permission to do this whole project from West Park Utilities and or the Farlight HOA.
Susan, a question came up while you were out of the room. What latitude do we have on negotiating somebody coming into the district for hookup fees?
For delaying spreading them out?
Or
modifying.
Can we say if they were supposed to pay, typically if they were supposed to spend $1,000, could we not negotiate $800?
I have to go back and read all of our ordinances before I can give you a final solution. I can tell you, I don't think you're going to, if we've adopted certain pricing, I'll call it,
right,
annexation and requirements, I don't believe you could negotiate anything that's not within our ordinance. We may be able to, under an annexation agreement, extend those out over a period of time.
Is there any state law that says that you can't give one person a better deal than another?
Absolutely. We can't treat people differently. That's why I said I would have to go back.
If there is something good on our end because we're getting wastewater disposal, does that change any of that?
It, again, as part of an annexation agreement, because we may be getting a value upside, we may be able to say the overall costs for annexation are offset so that you would spread the total amount of, I'm going to call it, that spread the total amount of the reduction, there's an offset against all of the properties, and that may modify how we look at an annexation charge, you know.
Okay.
But we have to actually to get a lot of, I don't know those words, but I would tell you generally, I mean, other than an offset, the only thing we can do is spread out
the cost.
Payments.
Yeah. 20 years or whatever it would be.
Yeah.
So, do we have a plan to move forward on this, Ron?
Let me ask one more question. Assuming we spend $133,000 on testing and the data comes back that it would be favorable as far as us being able to have additional disposition capacity, where is the $2 or $3 million? That is, I hear we're going to need to spend. Where would that come from? Would that come from within the grant that we've got from tax board, or does that have to be money that it comes out of whatever the reserve funds are of the water and sewer board?
That is part of the 1%. It does have to come from the district, or would have to come from West Fork or HLH or some combination of the two. Or
so it isn't going to come. It isn't going to come from the tax resort.
No, no, that's on the other. That's on the downslope side of your topography there versus upstream here.
Okay, thank you. That kind of mitigates against it in my mind.
So is the other members of the board, are they okay with them go on this dual track for the next month? Is that if Mark can put out the bid these things,
these wells, we go ahead with that, but we delay approving the $135,000 until we have an idea of the HOA and where they lie on this potential. And then next month, we could either say go or no go to Mark.
This is Dick. That works for me.
That works for me.
Susan, that I guess that next month could we kind of research and see where we are as far as what we can, what latitude we have to work with connection fees.
Sure.
Great, thank you. All right.
And then we'll, Matt chatted as well that he's amenable to a call to discuss all this. He'll be available for a call to discuss. So.
Okay.
He's interested in moving this forward as well. And then we'll reach out to the HOA to coordinate presenting something at their August 11th meeting.
Okay. You send out that what you're going to present before the meeting.
Sure.
To the board members.
Yes.
All right. So,
I'm just gonna hit unmute all again to see if there's any other comment on this agenda item before we.
My biggest concern is that we start up the treatment plant and have removed the 7,088 SFEs. And turned that into, I think it's 10,800 SFEs on the treatment side. But right now, if nothing else happens, you only have 7,284 SFEs based on Ray Armstrong's calcs before you need either additional storage or snowmaking or groundwater discharge or whatever it may be. So just keep that in mind. I mean, that's like another year maybe of growth in your district.
Yeah, I don't think we're slowing down this work though, Scott, is
yep.
We're trying to rise in the full contractor.
Yep, I understand.
But you know, isn't in the end of this, not in the end of it, in the middle of it, is the state. Should we bring some of these ideas that we have? I mean, I heard you say, Scott, that, you know, that snowmaking was also a positive, would be a positive to our disposition capability, and it has about the same expenditures level that it would be required if we do the firelight. Now, sooner or later, we got to get the state to get moving to give us the idea of which one they would prefer if we can't make up our own minds.
The problem with snowmaking is that we don't have any control. It's not, I mean,
I understand that.
Not that we do with firelight either right now, but we don't, you know, you don't own the land. You don't have the operators that would do it. You can't make it happen. You can provide the water and hope it happens.
So what I hear you saying now is that a bird in the hand would be the firelight rather than a potential for snowmaking.
Yes, and I'm also, you know, just saying that whatever's going to happen with that additional storage in YC needs to happen. You know, that we're talking 3 years of capacity based on, you know, current high growth before you need that storage, according to Ray Armstrong's calcs, which I have not dug into myself. I just I'm trusting his capacity letters.
Question for Mike Dukenroy. Where are we on the Yellowstone Club?
I think he had sent me an email. He said he was on the call, but I don't know if he is or not.
You don't know anything, do you, Ron?
No, but Scott and I had a meeting with Rich Chandler, I want to say, month and a half ago, and Rich gave us an update that they were putting something forward to the state on it, but I haven't heard anymore.
Okay, well, I think if there's no other comments or questions, are we going on to the mountain wells?
Yeah, real quick while we're on this, it seems like we keep kind of bumping into the snowmaking issue we did. Kind of waiting on YC to apply and go through the DEQ process. I don't know where that's at, but we don't seem to be making a lot of headway. Do we want to start our own kind of application, start making headway ourselves in that process? Because this is potentially a huge piece to the puzzle and winter disposal. I could factor into our firelight decisions here. That's feasible or not feasible. Just keep kind of kicking the can down the road with that thing.
I believe they have submitted the DEQ. Yeah. They frankly can move faster than we can with something like this, since their proposals on property they own, right, and their staff would be doing this. So.
That is for their effluent, not your effluent.
Right. But we share the same source with them, so indirectly it would be ours as well. Because we're pumping up, or have the ability to.
So is your thought, Ron, that based on their results of their application, that it becomes easier for us to move through that process?
Correct.
Yeah.
Has Big Sky Resort agreed to allow us to dispose of the wastewater via snowmaking on their property?
There's interest there. Offset their consumptive use of groundwater. It's treated water. Also, the Lake Levinsky, they've been trying to keep that full, correct?
Yes, and all the snowmaking that Big Sky does, it's kind of on the wrong side of the hill. Our pipelines, supplies. It's not, there's been talk about building a snowmaking storage pond on top of andesite. I'm not exactly sure where that would be geographically, but I know they have been looking at that as a potential future.
And I think Spanish Peaks has interest. And they have the pond there.
Right.
And so, there is, there are ponds and the pipeline is close to where some of the snowmaking could occur if it was approved, but yeah.
I think Brian, that takes care of Spanish Peaks, that side of andesite, kind of going down into the Montage project. I'm not entirely sure that that really, checks the box for the balance of the Big Sky Resort property and there's enough capacity, we're going to be able to dispose of enough on Spanish Peaks, essentially, versus what we could gather or dispose of if we had the balance of the Big Sky Resort property above the treated wastewater fees to make.
And it's just hard to get that treated wastewater over the ridge, right?
Right, it would involve more pipelines, but we can get water to the pond by the golf course clubhouse at Spanish Peaks, which isn't far from the base of Southern Comfort. Realistically, that's where we would start. I believe Spanish Peaks is going to have need for snowmaking capacity down there.
Once so, John here. We do have an additional pond planned on the golf course. Probably another 12 to 13 million gallons that we will be probably constructing next year that will be a freshwater snowmaking pond. It will be dedicated for snowmaking. And you know, we will obviously design, construct to DEP standards. So in the future, if we are able to use effluent for snowmaking, we will be able to convert that to a snowmaking facility. Regarding the pond that we've talked about over the years on top of andesite, we are trying to find ways to provide enough storage without building a pond on top of that big rock mound that we do not eventually need to build that. But we're still working on those designs or those capacities. So that's where we're at with the Spanish Creek site.
Thanks, John.
From a snowmaking perspective, it seems like YC asked if they're successful, you know, getting approval to use wastewater for snowmaking. That seems to me like that's the first step. I don't think we should be more involved from the district perspective. I think they should get that box checked first. And if they are successful, we can potentially take next steps. With regard to Firelight, if we spend $133,000, what are the chances that this testing process, the test wells and so forth, what are the chances that this could fail? Would we be able to use Firelight Meadows as a disposal site? Is it a 50-50 proposition that we could potentially use that, or is it less or greater than that?
We don't know right now, but we would get some idea fairly early into this testing. I would expect it to turn out more favorable than what we've seen in the present data.
Yep, Mark, we didn't get the first half of what you said, but Mike, it's hard to wrap your head around how they'd be going from 30 or 40 milligrams per liter total nitrogen at the discharge side to 2 milligrams per liter at the monitoring well. That's hard to understand. Now, they may have created a subsurface, you know, treatment wetland essentially with all the other carbon they're putting into the ground. And that's what we got to flesh out. But that would be an extremely complicated system that I don't think Mark and I could tell you, you know, it's 40% chance it's wrong. It's a 60% chance it's right. That's just too risky.
Fair enough. Well, it sounds like we have to, you know, consider this Firelight is really the only alternative at this point, given the fact that snowmaking has not been approved. And I feel, you know, we should more aggressively pursue the Firelight and spend $133 to move this forward to see if this is going to be an alternative for us.
Yep. I think you still have to keep pushing on all these potentials, but this one, unfortunately, you have to spend a little bit more money based on what we've figured out so far to make sure it's not a fool's errand.
Yeah, I guess I agree that we should spend this if we can't move ahead of this. That other component we've got to flesh out a little bit too. And I don't think we're slowing things down by not approving the full $135,000.
Yeah, fair enough, Tom. I think that, you know, getting the bids for the wells is appropriate and discussing that at the next board meeting following, you know, further discussions with Firelight, I think are the right steps here.
Okay.
So I think we're done with that agenda item. I think there was a lot of good discussion on that. The HOA and meeting with them on the 11th of August. Mark, since you're still on the call, could you report briefly on the Mountain Village well exploration project? I know our driller has been stalled a bit. If you could just give us a quick update.
Yes. The drillers had some issues that are delaying them from mobilizing to the site. He's told me that he can be there by the 15th of September and work continuously through the fall. So that, you know, we, assuming we can go through till November 1, you know, we should get 5 of the wells in. And so I talked to them and talked with, Ron about going ahead and writing them an extension on that contract till into 2021. So that next season, you know, so that they'll finish this next season. And so that's the status of it, right now. But he's, you know, he'll try to get there sooner. He says he can definitely get there on the 15th of September and works continuous from there. And these wells drill about one a week, not the alluvial wells, but the deeper wells. So, that's the status of it at this point.
Jim, you went around and looked at all the sites with Mark, and I think Brian was with you.
Bill and Brian just me and Mark.
Okay.
We offered to tour Brian, but he didn't pick us up on
it. So, you know what the hang up on this is?
Huh? Well, the only thing up is, well, the drillers pretty good. You should be busy, sex up. But other than that, I'm not sure 100% if Brian's happy with these applications, but I haven't heard of it.
Yeah, it's a little frustrating.
Yes.
It's pushed back.
Yeah.
Practically, I mean, we're hoping they can drill to November 1st, but the reality is, off different up here. I don't know how much we're going to get done this year.
All right. Well, okay. I'm not going to sell that one here.
Yep.
No. All right. Tanner, you're still on the call. Let's, cover the architectural rendering I've got pulled up on the screen. You and I met with a couple of your other folks last week. We toured the wastewater plant, looked at the site kind of extensively, and moving forward, this rendering, if you want to just speak to it and kind of walk through what you guys are thinking at this point.
Sure, yeah. As always, you know, things are kind of always in flux as we're deciding the stuff to wrap it for a CDU. So there's some small changes that can be to take place. I think this is a pretty accurate representation of where we're at today. The screen wall and around the room, you know, we look at the first rendering and sort of darken that up to add a little bit more warmth. To the entire facility, since we got a lot of black and gray, as well as something that doesn't look so crumbling. One of the things that, again, talking to one of the precast manufacturer, doing a board form pattern is there's a relatively low cost associated with it. So with the concrete that we're going to go that way, it's sort of a timeless look, and I can see one big guy would really like it. It's pretty subtle, and you would only be able to see it if you're up close, but I think it will, if you're walking your trails, you know, sort of a differentiation in texture instead of just an old sort of smooth concrete panel. Other than that, I mean, it just sort of shows the building in its context. You know, we're open to any feedback, and we continue to tweak it as everyone gets it.
So Tanner, when we met last week, brought in some samples, and I've got them here at the office, but there's it's an aluminum product that has some sort of, covering that's vinyl that gives it a wood look, and I guess six different samples that we looked at, roof colors, roofing patterns, that kind of thing.
That would be that all that wood with slatting?
That's exactly right. So the vertical stuff you see there, the slatting would be this material, which I like because it's a no maintenance product. And I don't think, and what we talked about is making, maybe making those a little darker. I don't know that we've got the bright shade here in the office, sure. But there's other ones out there that we could choose.
Yeah, and you know, to follow up on that, it's a really great product. It's a great warranty. It's a durability. It's a long-term product. It's a foil finish space, and it's a really strong product. It's easy to install. So if it ever gets picked up, like, it's really easy to replace. And this is the only thing that would actually be true would the columns and the beams. And everything else would be very low maintenance, and the columns and beams would be stained and sealed to match the quote unquote wood.
And then the concrete there, the picture, that would be a stamped concrete form.
That's correct. Yeah, it was a subtle stamp, but you know, they call it board form, and again, it's sort of a timeless look, and you can find it a lot in Montana. I think it's just got a wonderful texture to it, and it really fits with the aesthetic, not only for everything else we're doing in the building, but also really in the area. The commonly used thing in the club and other places.
So one of the questions that came up after our meeting, Tanner, was on the fencing, and the question was, can the fences tie into the building structure, or does it have to wrap around the front side of this between the road and the building? I think it's going to have to wrap between the road and the building. Usually what DEQ is going to want to see.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that further. You know, I'm open to a discussion, but obviously we want to take the DEQ's, you know, preference on that. But, I mean, we can accommodate anything that you see fit. You know, as you know, that our biggest obstacle was really that the south road and the south property line were pretty tight there. Other than that, I think we can, you know, adjust as needed.
Scott Buecher, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, if DEQ would be amenable to letting us just tie the fence in the sides.
Tanner, I had a question there on that westernmost portion of the building. There, would that also have that board form?
It does, and that actually has gone into the end of that. It is not well represented there in the way that it would look, and we will make that update. But if you have to, unfortunately, I apologize, this will have to be really, and it will look more like Eastern phase and have that.
Sure. Okay.
Which is good.
Yeah. Looked a little different when it was presented like that. Yeah.
Well, then, now,
sorry, I was muted there.
We won't be doing the texture anywhere on the north side. And that's mostly because of the future expansion. And it gives us the flexibility and it's easier to work with the skin surface to add on than it is texture.
Sure.
Right. Scott, you were speaking there for a second.
Yeah, I think if we tie the fence in at the sides and leave the front unfenced, I think, in my opinion, it's doable, but we are going to have do a deviation request with DEQ, and we would just have to have motion detection and potentially intercom warnings and things, just if a vehicle did drive up, to say, you know, you can't enter here.
I think that would be great if we could do that and not have to fence all the way around the front side of that.
Yeah, I think it would be better for access and So I'll put that on my list.
Okay. And Tanner, these what percent down would you say these are?
You know, I think close to the on the one side, and any feedback that we get from this meeting, we can incorporate into it. If you want to highlight something, or I don't know, any feedback we can ask it into it. Just to let you know, as I said earlier, you know, design continues, and we go through construction documents. We will continue to make tweaks on this. And this is the end of and we'll provide a number that is, you know, asked for this building. So keep that in mind.
All right, I'll email this rendering around to the board after the meeting so you've got this version to look at for any additional feedback. All right. Thanks, Tanner. That takes us down to the next
contract too.
Meadowview under developments and subdivisions, old business, Meadowview condos, track two, Sweetgrass Hills. That's the workforce housing project going together behind us. Laura Spang had sent an email. Just hit the gray button there. And let me pull that up. She had a letter in there from the Housing Trust. Some of the discussion you just had.
Perfect. So it's like an option. It's not the decrees, but we could propose a payment schedule if we wanted to, if I understand it correctly.
And again, I need to go, this is Susan, so only for the people on the video, but I need to go back and look at your ordinances as they're together, and I'm going to suggest before you take any action that if you're going to start talking about putting people on payment plans, that we consider and the board adopt a policy of how that applies. I mean, I think you've probably got some good criteria of nonprofits with specific purposes, but you don't want to just say every nonprofit can have a payment plan,
right?
Because they're all over the place. So we need, before you can do anything for this, you need to go back and look at, and if you're contemplating a payment plan, we need to look at what that criteria would be to allow people to apply for something.
But ultimately, we cannot decrease the connection fees.
Yes, you're correct.
Okay.
Or do we know that for sure?
You're not going to be able to have a whole separate set of fees
right.
for a different criteria.
Right.
So you cannot decrease them. The only thing you can do is spread them out.
And so we'll delay any even discussion on that until you've done your work.
Okay. And that's clarified with the fire like case or cases for protection that gives a monetary benefit or offset to annexing or connecting, then that would be modify the fee structure.
It wouldn't modify the structure, it would offset.
Or offset.
Right? I mean, it's lawyer semantics, but
yes.
It does make
yes.
a difference.
Right? It wouldn't change the actual fee, but it could change the global agreement.
Right.
Okay.
Laura, you're on the call. I've got your letter up there if you want to comment.
Well, it's pretty clear. We're just asking as trying to really provide a service to the whole community of this workforce housing. If we could have had reduced fees for these hookups, I understand, you know, the discussion that's preceded here about you can't treat people differently. So I think we would ask for payment plan to try to help us if we truly can't come up with reduced fees.
Okay.
I think we're amenable to looking at that based on Susan's feedback that we get at the next meeting.
Yeah, but we need a policy, and I think that was the other thing that Susan said. I agree with that, is that there are more not-for-profits here that are digging holes in the ground, and we need a policy that is well thought out. So.
Correct. We don't have a policy specific to these new nonprofits. Your policy is your ordinance.
Right.
In there is language where you can waive fees for public projects, fire departments, things like that. I can tell you, historically, we've done two of these, and it's been years since we've done them. We didn't reduce the fee, we put them on a payment plan. One was the Big Sky Apartments in the Mountain Village, which was done as a tax credit housing project. They ultimately did pay their fees. They struggled at times with that, but we did get full payment. And the second one was the church, the chapel here in the middle. They actually accelerated their payments and paid off and up their amortization. So we have done a couple. They were unique, but
did we charge them interest for delaying?
I don't think so. No, we gave them time to pay the fee. There was no interest charge.
Okay. Yeah. So we potentially have a problem.
You've got precedents.
We got precedents, yeah, but no policy.
And the policy was in the ordinance, which does give the board discretion in there. And Susan will review that.
I would like a little more to that policy, if that's all there is in it, that we have discretion, because I think that's arbitrary and
depreciated, well, as
somebody would say. Is.
Well, it has the potentials.
Yeah, I would like something that says a little more cut and dry is how we go about doing it in the future.
Okay, I'll work with Susan. We'll look at that. And maybe that form is an amendment to that ordinance.
Tom, this is Dick. What is the amount for each unit?
Well, I have to do the math real quick for you, but it's about $150,000, and we have 52 units.
So 3,000 a unit.
Yep.
And that would be paid by the purchaser.
No, in a sense, because it's part of our construction cost. And so we had to roll construction costs into the sale to the owners.
Yeah, and some of that construction cost is offset by resort tax?
No, the resort tax fees were used to purchase the land. And we basically are covering our construction costs with our sales.
So this would be a rebate or a discount to the buyer.
I don't know how that works.
So the math on that, I've got the two permits summary there on the screen. So 34 units, $99,331, works out to $121 per unit. Some of those units are a little bigger than others, but that includes sewer and water metering equipment. Every unit is going to have its own water meter, so there's a number of things in there.
So how would you do a payment plan, even if you did one?
The bill goes to HRDC is who's paying for this.
Okay, so it would be to HRDC.
Right. Yes.
Couldn't the bill for each unit just be paid in full at closing of each property?
Well, that would actually, those closings are going to start happening in September here. So I think if we'd like a longer payment plan than that, if we could.
All right. Well, it sounds like Ron and Susan are going to go through our ordinances and come up with a recommendation for the board.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Laura.
Ron, what was the amount per unit again?
$2,921. Just taking the 99,331 divided by the 34 units there.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah.
And so they're doing the project in two phases. All of the work you see now finishes it out. There'll be a full build out after the second permit. The first permit has been paid. There's no anything different on that. 55, 351.
All right, we're on to the water meter.
Well, there was one other development I had in my report. This is Montana Club. That's been final platted. Got infrastructure in it, sewer water extensions. This is Boyd's development up in the Mountain Village. I don't know if Brian's still on the meeting call or not. That's FYI. And then down to the water meter use customer portal. We talked about this a few times. At the last meeting, Tom Reeves had mentioned that the community down in Arizona is using this portal provided by WaterSmart. And we did some investigating into that, did a demo with them. After going through it, Terry and I both agree that this is the one we should use. This checks all the boxes that we're looking for. And those boxes are, you know, where property managers can use it, kind of aggregate the properties that they take care of into their own accounts so they can look at their water usage. And then a big, big benefit to this is you can actually pay your bill through this platform. So before we were always looking at having one to see what your bill is, a way to pay that, but it wasn't integrated into looking at your water usage over time with all the meter data you get. This actually does that. And so our recommendation is to move ahead with this. It's not the cheapest option, but I think it's the best option. But it's not that much more, but I do think it just, like I said, check the whole box. Gary, so, I don't know if you want to add to
that. No, I just second your recommendation.
So going to this, how soon could this be up and running? Is it too late for this quarter? Are we seeing, are you monitoring, water usage for people? Because I've been watching some of my neighbors and they're irrigating like there's been no change. And I'm sure they're not aware of this. And,
I would say we're monitoring for continuous use. We're not monitoring for volume. Well, if somebody's running 24 hours a day, we see it. You know, if they're just running, using a lot of water.
Or Marlene, the first week of October.
Yeah, it's gonna be easy.
Well, as far as implementing the new platform, to have it going by October 1st,
it would be, yeah, it would be easy to do.
But that
fourth quarter of this year.
So, just to clarify, it's app-based, so people can run an app on their phone.
It's web-based, but they have a mobile responsive rendering that makes it look like an app, but it really is a web-based thing. And when you look at their website, and I had a link in the board packet for that, they show kind of what that looks like through the mobile app.
I guess when I switched over my water from, because I'm in Arizona, when I bought it, the first week I signed up for the water district, they sent me an email that a new
unusual usage, and I think it had to do with the timing of the switchover. So probably paying for the former owner's water a little bit, but I haven't gotten anything since then. But they gave me a warning right away that I think is automated.
Yeah, you did, man.
Yeah, and I think that'd be a good thing for this quarter, especially.
Yeah, one of the really nice things is even if you're not registered with them, if there's an issue, you're going to get noticed. So
you'll get an email.
Whatever contact information that we have available for that customer. You don't have an email, you don't have a phone number, and they have, you'll get a letter in the mail.
And the parameters would be set by us then, 24-hour usage of a certain amount or something. We would designate those alert levels.
Or 20% over normal.
Sure.
What their pattern has been and something like that, yeah.
Sounds promising. Do we have a kind of budget or?
Well, it's in budget for customer portal. It's actually going to be a little bit more than
how much more?
Approximately 10,000 the first year.
What?
And then going forward, it's in the same ballpark.
What did we budget for it?
I believe we budgeted around 18,000.
Okay. And first year's going to be 10,000 more, and then. That point forward.
Yeah, but going forward, it's an annual fee.
Uh-huh.
And they're all pretty
current. Okay. So basically, it's a one-time increase in cost. Okay. What do you think?
Well, I'm all in favor because we've got to, it's not that cost of water in this community and giving consumers the ability to manage their own bills and manage our resources that we're providing for them is a good thing. So,
do you need a vote from us?
I'm going to pull up the quote here real quick just so everybody can see what kind of cost.
Well, even the budget, the increase, I'll have them have amended numbers for our next meeting.
Okay, but so we can insert it then.
If you guys go forward with the Canadian project, that's an additional budget item that we didn't budget.
All right, so we'll deal with that next meeting.
Yeah. Okay. But in either case, we could have this up right by October 1st.
That's the plan.
Set the course now.
Are any of the other board members philosophically have a problem with spending this extra for this portal?
No.
No, I'm fine.
I've been having problems with that one.
Well, this is on this computer. First one went through fine. So I'll forward those out to the cost quote. And then just as a FYI on this whole business with the new rates and the irrigation uses, we put this in the bills that went out beginning of July, letting people know we've got new rates. Calculator, if you want to know what it's going to cost you, that QR code takes you to that calculator so people do have the ability to kind of check. And then we reminded them of our irrigation restrictions. And then on the back side of that, we put our new rates there. So everybody got those in the bills and hopefully they pay attention to it.
I'm sure they do. Given that, for instance, I don't get a water bill yet. An email from Carrier, that's not in there, is it?
No. But I do, within the email, I'm telling you there's new rates back to January 1st through our website, our web address, and all the information.
Well, there. So, I mean, it's hard to get people to focus until they actually get a bill.
Right.
And that's why
you need to do something special for my wing.
We also put a notice on the website that the renter no longer
yeah.
So that my report. So this is the quote that comes through. Set up fees at one time. The platform, what was that? $2 per meter.
Yeah, and the minimum.
The minimum is 10,000. So they, their business model doesn't allow a small system like ours to really benefit by reducing costs. So it is more expensive, but it does do everything we need it to do. And then these things here are just marketing costs to get the system up and running. This on-site training would go away. We would do that virtually. We would travel them in here. So I think we need that. But
okay.
Anyway, that's the gist of it.
And that $10,000 annual fee is comparable to other platforms that we felt so in have. Same functionality.
A little bit more. Again, I think it's worth it.
So, Terry, would you get rid of your current billing, automated billing, and go to this, or is this an addition?
This is an addition.
Okay.
It's got some online payment options that are interesting that we'll have to figure out. Looked at a couple that are pretty user-friendly, and they allow people to pay their bill or pay with ACH right online, which is something real.
All right. New business.
Down there. Under new developments, we received some new submittals. I've got area languages showing where those are. This is in Town Center. This is an extension of their linear park. And then another one in Town Center, Huntley Commons, across from Essentia Condos. And then Powder Light has been sold or is being sold, and they're looking at doing some more extension work down in Powder Light, which is below the hardware store here. So we're reviewing plan sets for those three.
So that's no longer Scott Hall?
Some of it still might be, but I've heard Low Mountain Lands buying some of that.
Company,
yeah. That's the new developments, and then sewer permits. Our ongoing list, we're still sitting at 281 for new projects. List going down back through January 1st. General correspondence, Casey Hayes, they put one email in this section of the packet. Pre-COVID, I had offered, you know, our space here, this community room for polling place for the general election in November. And Casey's reaching out to us again to see if that still works. We were at a drop-off site for the June election. We
did work outside.
It was outside. Kate worked that.
And she's done.
She has done.
Yep.
Good for her.
Yep.
She did it a long time. So, my feeling is we could do it. We've got cleaning procedures. We are letting some meetings back in here. If it's done right, we could use this space. But I at least wanted to open up at the meeting.
Well, first of all, it's hard to comment on something that this has been a fluid situation in this country. And it's hard to give him a specific answer for something that's 4 months away. Because this whole thing started, 4 months ago or something like that.
Seems a lot longer.
It's a lot has changed in a short period of time. I would, from our standpoint, kind of give them not, can't give them my total answer one way or the other, but give them some, I would say, shut down the office for that day.
I thought so too. Yep.
And thinking that maybe they ought to be responsible for professional cleaners to come in after polling to clean the office, clean the space that they use. I don't think that's unreasonable that, why should we, we're not experts in cleaning, and get somebody professional. That's what restaurants are doing. If they have a COVID employee, and also require entry to the building, ask that be masked up.
Yes. Yep.
Limited number.
And limited numbers. Good. So I think we need to put in some.
You're an election.
I am.
So you know well aware of what's going on.
Well, and you're absolutely right. Nobody knows really what's going on, and they're still struggling to figure out. I mean, we could have a blizzard that day, and that would mean that people would have to sit in their cars, and there would have to be somebody outside to let people in. I mean, I think they're going to have to do that kind of monitoring. We can't have people piling up in line, even with masks on. They're not, you know.
I mean, if the state was smart, they'd go to secure boxes like mailboxes that people could drop it off, and without an election, three election people at each site to watch them drop it off, but have a secure, as secure as the mailboxes, because you can mail in now, it's too, so it's no different. But who knows whether the state's going to come to that conclusion.
Well, our legislature just changed the requirements for even dropping off somebody else's ballot.
Right.
So we made it more difficult
to
assist that, not less. With that said, people are always having they have the ability to ask for an absentee and then vote it and mail it in. So it's up to kind of the individual voter from that standpoint to they hold the authority for purposes of saying, I want to vote by mail. And you can do that. You make those requests and you'll get the absentee ballot. Then you fill it out, mail it back in, but then you get the last day drop offs. I will tell you that there are a good number of people who want to vote at a polling place, part of their tradition. It's going to be difficult, but I there's nothing wrong with responding back saying we have thoughts about requirements for using our facility.
Kay told me for the primary here, they have 75 ballots dropped off.
75.
And I think total voting up here is probably 1,500 ballots or something like that. I guess what I'm saying is I'm not sure we can give them an answer. That if we do approve it, these are the criteria that we need to reduce the number of people inside Mayor's home line. They'd be responsible for cleaning with a professional, not, I don't want election judges having to clean because I think it's already a burden for the minimum wage that they're paying.
And I believe the general election is a state holiday. So the office would be closed anyway.
Yeah.
It checks that box. Okay. But I think those are all things. Get back to Jason.
Yeah. And that, we don't give them an absolute answer right now.
And I don't know what his drop dead date is, need to know. He's reaching out pretty early on.
I don't think he knows, that's
right. Beyond this, is there?
No.
Good school, but.
Historically, we have been a polling place for quite a while, so this is not unusual.
Right.
In the queue for this. Okay. That gives me enough to reply back.
And if Kay was still a chief election judge here, she would refuse to be in, given what we know today.
and be an auction judge on in-person voting. So,
well, there's a good number of issues, and that, I think that's why he's starting early, is because they have to secure places, and then they have to figure out personnel. And I mean, it is no easy task.
Yeah, most election judges are in that class of people that are more susceptible to severe consequences.
The vast majority of them are over 60.
Yes.
Period.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing.
Nothing except that they're vulnerable population.
I know. That's being one who's over 60 now. All right. Well, I'll get back to Casey with those thoughts. See where it goes. Last thing I've got under new business is the Cottonwood Law complaint has been filed with the court. Wrote up a little narrative in my report. I did talk to John Mayer before they filed it. We did send it to our insurance company. We've gotten a reply back from our insurance company that it would not be covered by our E&O. That we'll talk about with our counsel here, but I
have you been served?
Yes.
Okay.
This is all gone to Susan. I asked her if she could be at the meeting today to speak to this topic. It's been years since we've been sued. But it is what it is at this point, so we need to.
Want me to cover this?
No.
No. I'm going to ask the board to, as you know, you have very limited ability to close meetings to public comment. One of them is if you have been sued in an active litigation. Before you can close a meeting for purposes of that, you need to make a finding that it would be detrimental to the district's litigation position to have a discussion in public. And I am here because I want to have a discussion with you about the contents and possible defenses. I can't do that in a public meeting. And so I would ask a board member to make a motion to close the meeting, finding that we're going to discuss the contents of the complaint and that it would be detrimental to the district's litigation position to have that discussion in a public forum.
I would entertain a motion to that effect.
I'll make that motion. Is there any other business we should take care of before we close the meeting? And
I think knowing the next meeting date is on the agenda, yeah.
Okay. All
right. Yeah, I can. Peter Malka made a motion.
Do we need the
Dick Bath?
I'll second.
Thank you. And for both in favor, say aye.
Aye.
So, from aye. This on, I'm sorry, not a full vote. From this point on, I would, we need to, excuse everybody who is not a member of the board.